watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On the show last week, we heard how the debt and interest-based financial system is fundamentally incompatible with a sustainable way of life on the planet. By definition, a sustainable system is one where inputs and outputs balance, where growth and decay repeatedly return to equilibrium, which is the way ecosystems function. The modern industrial economy, a human creation, depends upon ever-increasing growth racing to service an ever-increasing quantity of debt-based money that must be repaid with compounding interest. The economic system we have is reflected in the culture we have, atomized, wasteful, fearful, insecure, aggressive. Last week, we heard from Hugo Blanco, an indigenous human rights activist from Peru, who spoke about the rising political movements in South and Central America that reject this culture being imposed upon them. They seek to create governments that embody their ancient values of solidarity, community, and respect for the earth in a contemporary context, an idea that some are calling eco-socialism. This week, we'll hear the remaining speakers from a panel on ecosocialism held at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, BC, last month. Rejection of capitalist economy, law, and social structures is not just the province of indigenous movements from the global south. The culture that Hugo Blanco spoke about last week is actually the ancient heritage of all human beings. Money and markets are human inventions, and for most of our existence as a species, our social relations functioned on very different terms, which Genevieve Vaughan, whose book For Giving I began reading last week, calls the gift economy. This week, I'll continue reading from the book in the latter part of the show. Most everyone listening to this right now will never have experienced a society not based on buying and selling, debtors and creditors, or a world in which everything is seen as having a price and is valued accordingly. It is a world in which we are forced to obtain money, whether by producing items to sell or by renting our own bodies for a wage determined by someone else, abstractly referred to as the market. We have been told that this is the best possible way to meet human needs, and furthermore, that without this system, needs would not be met efficiently or sufficiently. Some even suggest that without this essentially coercive system, human beings would not make the necessary effort to meet the needs of society. Many speakers on this show have documented the way in which this system fails abjectly to meet the needs of many people and have shown that it is constructed in a way that precludes it from ever doing so. The ideas expressed by Vaughan that we could live well in a society based on giving rather than exchange are considered too beyond the mainstream to be seriously considered. I'm glad that I can at least give them an airing in this small corner of the world of public discourse. Vaughan argues that we are so indoctrinated into marketplace values, we fail to notice the great extent to which even our present society depends upon work done without pay and needs met without price, because these things are devalued. If we do things only under the compulsion to receive money, and would not do them in the absence of the necessity to seek money, ought those things to be done at all? How does it benefit us to be forced to do these things? And why do we put up with it? In what way do we have a free society? Only in the sense that if we can get a lot of money, we can make others do things for us that we would not do for them. We are free to try to attain a position where we can make other people into objects and tools. This seems an ugly sort of freedom to me, because one person's freedom requires another's oppression. In our society, we are not held responsible for others' oppression or freedom or well-being. Even when we do have the social programs the right-wingers so despise, they are constructed to inflict the maximum humiliation and control while providing the most minimal help. They seem to be designed by miserable, angry people who want to make sure that their misery has company. Hugo Blanco and the movement he is a part of are repudiating this culture. Joel Covell, who we're about to hear, calls it a culture of death.
Tonight's event is sponsored by Seven Oaks Magazine. My name is Derek O'Keefe. So our first speaker, Dr. Joel Covell, he shared with us, as I said, he's a very rigorous scholar, an intellectual that challenges you, and that's why I'd encourage everyone to buy both of his books that'll be for sale outside today, Overcoming Zionism and also The Enemy of Nature, which is really one of the founding texts, one of the important texts in the emerging thought around eco-socialism. Dr. Covell does not limit himself to intellectual activity, and he was sharing a funny story with us the other night over dinner. Well, actually, it's not funny at all, but we always try to have lighthearted conversations, but we always come back to the everything that's wrong with the world, and a good sense of humor as well. So what he was sharing with us was about the fact that he challenged Ralph Nader in 2000 for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States. So he pointed out that, in fact, he had changed the course of history because he might have changed the course of history had he defeated Ralph Nader for the Green Party nomination for President of the United States. By his own assessment, Al Gore would have then won by a wide enough margin that George Bush couldn't have stolen the election. And I might add, Al Gore most likely would not be speaking at a $500 ticket event brought to you by Toyota Global TV, the David Suzuki Foundation, and many others in a couple of weeks about his film, An Inconvenient Truth. So in many ways, intellectual and also potentially in the terms of U.S. politics, Joel Covell has made important contributions to the world, and we welcome almost made some and is contributing to future changes in the world with his ongoing work. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Joel Covell.
Thank you, Derek, and thank you all for being here, and thank you also for pointing out the forthcoming event where the once and future president of the United States is going to ask for, well, only $250 for ordinary people, so if you're ordinary, you can only have to pay $250 for this. But I think you should all welcome him appropriately with that. I should say that I have also completed a DVD, which will be soon released, and you can buy it on your newsstands, ha, ha, ha. But it's called A Really Inconvenient Truth, and it's Joel Covell deconstructing Al Gore, both of whom, Covell and Gore, lost races for the presidency in the year 2000. But there's more to it than that. I'll begin with a quote from one of the bete noirs of the left, Thomas Friedman, who is a columnist for the New York Times. Karl Marx once, in the Grundrisse, writing about Jeremy Bentham, the English utilitarian philosopher, said that Bentham was a, quote, genius of bourgeois stupidity. And we like to think of Thomas Friedman in that light, but here is Thomas Friedman seemingly seeing the light, and I just want to point this out to you. He writes the other day, and I'll skim over this, that he visited two cities that you may never have heard of, Doha, which is the capital of Qatar in the Persian Gulf, and Dalian, which is in the northeast China. What is stunning, writes Friedman, that I hadn't seen either city for more than 3 years, and I barely recognized either one. In Doha, since I was last there, a skyline that looks like a mini Manhattan has sprouted from the desert. The sleepy harbor now has a profile of skyscrapers, thanks to a huge injection of oil and gas revenues. Dalian, in China, with 6 million people, already had a mini Manhattan. It seems to have grown two more since. Can you imagine, he writes, how much energy all these new skyscrapers in just two cities you've never heard of are going to consume, and how much CO2 they are going to emit. He goes on, yes, Americas are popping up all over now. People who once lived low-energy lifestyles but by dint of oil wealth or hard work are now moving into U.S.-style apartments, cars, and appliances. Our planet cannot tolerate so many Americans unless we take the land and change and change what it means to be an American in energy terms. Attention, Kmart shoppers. The world consumed about 66 million barrels of oil a day in 1990. We are now consuming 83 million barrels a day, 17 years later. Demand for oil has grown 22% in the United States since 1990. China's oil demand has grown nearly 200% in the same period. By 2030, the global thirst for oil is forecast to increase by another 40% if we maintain business as usual. Such an appetite would devour every incremental green initiative we make. Hey, I'm really glad you switched to long-lasting compact fluorescent light bulbs, but this growth in Doha and Dalian are all your energy savings for breakfast. I'm glad you brought a hybrid car, but Doha and Dalian devoured that before noon. I am glad the U.S. Congress is debating whether to bring U.S. auto mileage requirements up to European levels by 2020. Doha and Dalian will have these gains for lunch, maybe just the first course. I'm glad that solar and wind power are soaring towards 2% of U.S. energy generation, but Doha and Dalian will devour all those gains for dinner. I am thrilled that you are now doing the 20 green things suggested by your favorite American magazine. Doha and Dalian will snack on them all like popcorn before bedtime. But it is not about them. It is still very much about us. He quotes a new express delivery company named TNT, which, quote, operates 35,000 trucks and 40 aircraft in Europe. We just bought two Boeing 747, which, when fully operational, will do 9 round trips every week between our home base in Belgium and in Shanghai. They leave Liège only partly full and every day fly back to Europe and so forth. By our calculations, just these two 747s will use as much fuel each week as our other 48 aircraft combined and emit as much CO2. And so this, it sounds like Thomas Friedman has awakened and seen the light that the fundamental problem is the insane growth of the capitalist system. But have no fear. He still is a genius of bourgeois stupidity, because here's how he finishes, which is the same way that Al Gore finishes. That's why we're fooling ourselves. There is no green revolution, or if it is, the counter-revolution is trumping it at every turn. That's true, okay? But then he goes on to say, without a transformational technological breakthrough in the energy space, all of the incremental gains we're making will be devoured by the exponential growth of all the new and old Americans. Now, there he goes. He hits the wall that he cannot surpass, because to surpass it would mean seeing beyond changing society, changing the energy pattern by changing technologies, looking for technological fixes. And basically that's what I tell about Al Gore when I take him on in my videotape, A Really Inconvenient Truth. The really inconvenient truth is that, yes, we must make very fundamental changes, but no, technology in itself is not at all the answer. We need a social transformation. We need a transformation in production and consumption. We definitely need a transformation in consumption, but that implies a transformation in production. And transformations in production means we have to look at the ruling system of production, which is capitalism, and we have to finally say, enough of this. This is a system that is destroying us. If you had a disease of this sort, you would not compromise with it if you were a rational person. If you were a rational civilization, you would not compromise with this disease. You would not stop at anything short of bringing it down and making this change. And anything I say tonight pales beyond that insight, because I don't have a blueprint for the change. I have some fundamental ideas about the kinds of parameters that are necessary for the change. It's up to humanity to fulfill those changes and to do it in respect to the full complexity, because we have a world where you have a dominant system of production, capitalism, and then you have all kinds of alternatives and reactions to it. You have a vast panoply of peoples, north and south. And I think what you're going to hear from Hugo Blanco shortly, I'm sure of it, and I look forward to hearing it, is how some of these things appear in the global south. Here we are in the global north, but we have one single global economy. We have to learn how all of the parts of that global economy work and how all of those parts can be brought together in a mighty battle against this ruling system of production that is dragging the planet and ourselves and our civilization and indeed our species to destruction. I would call capitalism, I'm going to do some reading from here so I can make some points in a compressed way and have enough time for a good discussion later on. I call capital the efficient cause of the crisis, the prime driving force, the elimination of which is the essential condition for an ecologically sane future. This is because the capitalist economy produces things in order to produce capital, which is the value term that expands. The chief product of capitalism is capital. In order to produce capital, it produces commodities because the capital is embedded in a nascent form in the commodities, and the commodities have to be produced on an ever-expanding terrain because of the competition between capitalist firms, so that if any of them does not expand, it will be eaten by somebody else, because it's a privately owned means of production that drives the capitalist system onwards. We talk sometimes, we hear sometimes talking about limiting capitalism, you know, having community capitalism, having citizens' movements that control the rate of growth of capitalism. I want to disabuse you of this notion. You do not limit capitalism. If you do limit capitalism, which is a good idea, you will at the same time destroy capitalism, because growth, the growth term, the expansion of money, is the lifeblood of capitalism. You might say, I guess I'll limit how much I breathe, you know. I'll breathe, you know, 5 minutes on and 5 minutes off. You can't do that. You will die if you do that. Capitalism is the same way. It cannot be limited. It can only be as it is, or it will destroy itself. And that's indeed what we have to do, but we have to think of what lies beyond it. Now, when I talk about eco-socialism, what I mean is this. It's the name we give to a form of society that would adequately meet the criterion of bringing capitalist production down and replacing it. The prefix eco signifies that it is the pattern of relationships between humanity and nature that needs to be healed, as expressed in a set of values that we may call ecocentric. And the stem, socialism, refers to a lengthy tradition of building alternatives to capitalism, all of which significantly have more or less come to a bad end at this point, and in some cases, notably China and the former Soviet Union and its satellites, have been prodigiously destructive to nature as well. Why should eco-socialism be any different? Let's look briefly at why socialism failed in its first epoch. Politically, the societies in which these socialist revolutions took place were unprepared for democratic self-management. Strategically, they were weak, war-torn, and under attacks of all kinds from the dominant capitalist powers. Economically, they were both backward and peripheral in relation to the dominant economic interests. First epoch socialism was therefore like the proverbial fruit that fell close to the tree. Its goal became to liberate labor from capital, but it saw the implementation of this goal as more of a redistribution of capital's benefits rather than a qualitative transformation of the mode of production itself. It remained essentially trapped in the idea of ever-expanding production, as you can see if you look at the speeches made by the Soviet leaders and then by Mao Zedong and so on. The idea did not question the industrial model through which this expansion unfolded. The ideas of limiting growth or working in harmony of nature were scarcely ever conceived, much less put into practice. In contrast, eco-socialism is grounded in the transformation of capitalist production. This is essential to the resolution of the ecological crisis, as it is capitalist production and not the distribution of its product among classes that breaks down nature. Let's look briefly at the crisis as it surfaces in its most momentous form, the questions of energy, global warming, and the carbon economy. I'll be very compressed here. We can expand on this in the question period if you like. First, the best climate science tells us that we have very little time before runaway positive feedback effects take hold, for example, through the melting of ice caps and glaciers. These will likely make the planet Earth unlivable unless there is a drastic diminution of the order of 90% of the transfer of carbon from below ground to the atmosphere. We have to put it in the starkest possible terms. The fundamental issue is to stop transferring carbon from the ground to the air. It sounds simple, but ha, the whole industrial capitalist civilization runs on it. Second, the dominant ideologies and structures, including academia and established science, and that's all too true, respond to this profound challenge with business as usual. They use various economic instruments to allow capital to accumulate and hope to check atmospheric carbon essentially by means of technological fixes, a la Thomas Friedman. He goes right up to the threshold and says, we need technology. And that's what Gore says. The Kyoto Protocols, which regulate planetary regime to limit carbon, are entirely constructed along such lines. In other words, they turn over the regulation of the climate crisis to the capitalist class itself. And the next generation of protocols will undoubtedly do the same unless mass action from below stops it from doing so. Okay? Third, since capital is money in motion and lives through the generalization and expansion of commodity production, and since the transfer of carbon from ground to air is a function of commodity production through the industrial system, it follows that however indirect and mediated the path, it is the accumulation of capital itself that spews death-dealing carbon into the atmosphere. It also follows that to the extent that the instruments of capital, like Kyoto, work, they do so by allowing capital to grow. I mean, that's the reason that Kyoto is accepted, because it has the plum that people are going to make a lot of money by limiting carbon. You know, but what they will do, of course, if they make money in a capitalist system, is then be faced with the dilemma that every capitalist has when he makes money, which is, what am I going to do with it? Well, I have to invest it. What am I going to invest it in? That which produces the greatest value, and so on and so forth. So the more money that is made to accumulation by Kyoto is only going to be turned into more airliners, more, you know, SUVs and whatever the system has, but it's to expand. It's very important to bear that in mind. There's a fundamentally self-defeating mechanism at place when you have a capitalist criterion. Therefore, the instruments of capitalist society eventually but inevitably worsen global warming through expansion of the economic product, a chaotic expansion, it must be added, as capital can do no other. It is no longer, in short, capitalism is not simply unsustainable, it is a culture of death and indeed suicidal. An eco-socialist alternative seeks to replace capitalist accumulation through a social transformation whose ground is ecological integrity. Thus, it achieves sustainability through the affirmation of life. Eco-socialism is a kind of visionary path whose steps are intermediate struggles drawn from the spontaneously appearing challenges thrown forth by the ecological crisis at different points of the globe. Challenges appearing in the north, for instance, in terms of the necessity of attacking the Kyoto protocols, finding alternative means of energy and production. Challenges in the south, which you're going to hear about from Hugo Blanco. So it's the same global system, but it produces different spontaneously challenged appearing opportunities at various points of the globe as its contradictions unfold. So each site of such contradictions, a struggle can emerge to proceed in an anti-capitalist direction and replace capitalist production. Now, the word intermediate that I mentioned is a crucial and essential. Eco-socialism, like life itself, cannot spring all at once into being. It is, I would say, prefigurative. That's a very important word. It takes embryonic shape in numberless ways that contain within themselves the lineaments of an ecologically integral world. Prefiguration expresses the germ of the future, and as it moves towards that future, it evolves with other elements of an eco-socialist configuration. In the case of climate change, eco-socialism would consist of the incorporation of all prefigurative practices whose common ground is the inhibition of the transfer of carbon from earth to sky, and that also work against the regime of accumulation. This would extend from struggles in the global south to block the life-destroying extraction of petroleum from indigenous lands, as is taking place in a great number of places in northwestern South America, in Bolivia and Ecuador and the like. And that's something I hope we get into later on, okay? It would also entail struggles against the ravages of the so-called clean development mechanisms of the Kyoto protocols, which, again, tear up the lands of the South in order to put forth various kinds of schemes to sort of plant eucalyptus trees and so on. They not only tear up the lands, but they tear up the peasantries, they tear up the communities, they break the ecological integrity that people have established between themselves and the land. And this also goes for the regime of biofuels, which is a terrible fraud that the world is being conned into for two reasons, one of which is that it produces a great demand on food and entails starvation and hunger and rising food prices. And the other is that it also entails the expansion of agricultural production into lands that are, again, inhabited by indigenous peoples that are relatively ecologically intact and inevitably turns them into monocrop plantations whose effects are eco-destructive on the larger scale. Okay, we can maybe talk more about that. Okay. In the global north, struggles against global warming would certainly include struggles against militarism and imperialism, against the oil wars, against the military, which is the biggest single consumer and waster of fuel, and certainly sees to it that the fuel keeps running. That's the point, okay? Alongside all those that break the power of the energy, oil, and automotive giants so that ecologically sane modes of transportation, energy production, etc., can arise. Such a strategy involves democratizing the state, introducing new forms of cooperative enterprise, developing superior technologies within the context of new social relations, and putting them into autonomous practices and so on. In other words, there's no blueprint or single path, but there's an ensemble of practices that come together in a vision of an ecologically integral world. There is no privileged agent to eco-socialist politics, and the only end it entails is the provision of a new global society in harmony with nature. All prefigurative practices point in this direction. This gives them unity and grounds for solidarity and organizations between North and South and within the North and within the South. And because prefigurative paths contain the germ of their goal, however far one goes along them through the struggle against accumulation will benefit life. Therefore, though the end of the eco-socialist transformation cannot be foretold, each individual prefigurative step will be beneficial in itself as an improvement of the existing world and a harbinger of a transformed world. Now, I'd like to just conclude with some basic principles here of an eco-socialist transformation, sort of drawing from some of these lessons. Eco-socialism is a socialism whose ground extends beyond the empowerment of labor to the restoration of the integrity of nature. For this, a new ecological mode of production is necessary, which is to be created from the elements of prefigurative activity. Now, as labor is the conscious and socially organized transformation of nature, the two aspects of eco-socialism, which exist roughly today as the red and the green tendencies, are actually deeply continuous and should not be treated as separate departments. The most radical demand of eco-socialism is precisely that restoration of nature's integrity requires the empowerment of human beings through the freeing of their labor. That is to say, the freeing it from capitalist exploitation. That is, although eco-socialism firmly supports appropriate technologies and direct intervention at sites of ecological degradation, its primary focus is on the way human beings are shaped to live within nature and to transform nature through labor. Eco-socialism holds that the alienation of labor makes for the alienation of nature and is, in fact, the rupture point in human history through which the degradation of nature and eventually the ecological crisis occurs. Therefore, an ecologically rational society needs to be free, where freedom is defined not in terms of bourgeois individualism and license, but as an ever-developing inclusiveness of the self. We require, in the memorable words of the Communist Manifesto that still stand as a touchstone of both socialism, first epoch, and eco-socialism, quote, an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. That is a quote from Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, The Communist Manifesto. In sum, a basic definition of eco-socialism is that it be a mode of production in which freely associated labor chooses ecocentric values to heal the earth and to make it flourish once again. The overcoming of accumulation is not, therefore, a general impoverishment of humankind. It is rather an overcoming of poverty that entails the redefinition of wealth. This involves multiple and interrelated shifts. One, from production for exchange to production for use. Two, from social relations ruled by quantity to those embodying qualities. We would call use values become the end of production and not the means to the end of expanding exchange value, money and capital. Three, from a society ruled by general estrangement and fetishism to one of mutual recognition. From another angle, this entails a shift from egotism to solidarity. Four, from the notion that the world consists of many disconnected, split-apart things to that it is an organically differentiated plenum. Nature should no longer be seen as something split apart from the human, but as the human body writ large. This entails a notion beyond use value and radically beyond exchange value, that the nature and the whole of the universe has an intrinsic value, a value which we receive from it without having to make anything out of it, indeed a value beyond production itself and in relation to which production takes shape. For production is the specifically human embeddedness in nature, yet before we produce, we live from nature. Next, from a society in the grip of addictive commodity consumption to one of self-determined production. We often fail to recognize how consumerism is a reaction to powerlessness, isolation, and spiritual despair. It is then both a consequence of capitalist alienation and a condition of ecological destruction, measured by ever-expanding waste dumps and wasted lives. In short, the more we are, the less we need to have. The more we have, the less we are. Since alienation, to go on, involves separation, eco-socialism, like socialism itself, is predicated on overcoming the separation of producers from the means of production. This is a nodal point at which the eco term joins the socialist term. A differentiated kind of connectivity defines the healthy ecosystem, one that flourishes and evolves. More broadly, the shift towards eco-socialism implies a shift from the generalization of commodity production, which is what capitalism is, to the producing itself of ecosystems. In other words, the goal is to make ecosystems and not commodities. That is to say, farms, workplaces, etc., can be seen as human ecosystems where the human being is part of nature but also its transforming agent. These flourish insofar as they follow the path of ecological integrity and degenerate insofar as they follow the path of accumulation. The commodity is the cell of capitalist society, and capital becomes an earth-ravaging cancer through the endless expansion of commodity production, which is the only way capital itself can be reproduced. The ecological crisis, from global warming to global pollution, is the sign of this cancer once it reaches a certain size and surpasses nature's planetary buffering devices. An ecosystem is a set of interrelated elements within nature, and nature is the integral of all ecosystems. A commodity cannot be an ecosystem since the exchange value within it depends upon separateness or alienation. That indeed is the foundation of money and the entry point into the process which eventuates in capital and the ecological crisis. Life is the self-replication of ecosystem, or the set of such replications, as the peculiar organs of an organism have each their own ecosystemic nature. That is to say, our circulation or endocrine systems are also ecosystems within a larger ecosystem. And each ecosystem is in association with all other beings. It is evident, then, that in producing ecosystems, whether these be gardens, freely evolving political associations, workshops, music, etc., we also reproduce our life. This perspective gives an insight into how a new eco-socialist mode of production can both sustain life and preserve the self without the interposition of commodity and money. Although, let me qualify, this does not mean that there is an absence of money in eco-socialism. It does mean that money now serves simply as a medium of exchange and not as a repository of value or a speculative commodity in itself. Of all commodities, the deadliest is the conversion of human creativity into labor power for sale in the labor markets for a wage. It is this that sustains capital and degrades humanity. Marx envisioned socialism or communism as an overcoming of wage labor. He saw this as part of the system, a vision, rather, of overcoming the separation of producer from the means of production. This remains a core eco-socialist goal to be worked out by creative people. There's one last momentous point distinguishing eco-socialism from first epoch socialism and capitalism, though it can be no more than mentioned here. We have observed that capital is a diseased fruit of a long process of development, in the course of which humanity became estranged from nature. Now, what was the point of origin of this process, the fall, if the term be used, of humanity from grace, and the beginnings of our estrangement from nature? I would argue and venture to say that this ensued from the estrangements of gender. In the course of male violence towards the female, an ancient crime whose consequences continue to unfold in male dominance and the submission of Mother Earth. Therefore, eco-socialism, in means and ends and like, is also an emancipation of gender and of all female principles, not as an ancillary to socialist development or an affirmative action program, but as integral to any strategy that seeks to heal the rift with nature that now threatens the survival of humanity. Thank you.
That was Professor Joel Covell, author of many books, including The End of Nature, The End of Capitalism, or The End of the World. He spoke at a forum on eco-socialism last month in Vancouver, B.C. Our next speaker was at that same event, recorded and shared by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock.
Following a year of land occupation and protests by Canadian First Nations people just outside of Hamilton, Ontario, a developer was severely beaten by Indigenous youth. Lindsay Bomberry, an Aboriginal activist, gave this emotional account of these events against the backdrop of centuries of cultural oppression. Lindsay was a guest speaking for First Nations on unceded territory in downtown Vancouver, Canada. We hear events in a way not reported by white-dominated media in Canada. Here is Linda Bomberry on September 21st, 2007.
Tonight's event is sponsored by Seven Oaks Magazine. My name is Derek O'Keefe. We will be hearing from another activist that we invited to speak with us, and that is Lindsay Bomberry, is going to tell us about the very important struggle by the Six Nations in resisting the expansion of a suburb, if you will, development in Ontario. This struggle has been going on in a very pitched way for the last year in Ontario, and has rallied solidarity from across the country and indeed around the world.
Sago. Well, As he mentioned, the name I'm called is Lindsay Bombery, but my real name is Gnosono. And why I think it's really important to acknowledge that is because my identity as an indigenous person or as an Ongwehongwe person, which is basically a word in our language that means indigenous people, means the people of the land. The reason why I feel it's important to mention that anytime I begin speaking is because retaining that identity is directly connected to the land for which we are descended from. Because we look at the land as not being something separate from ourselves. It's not about reconnecting with nature. It's about reconnecting with ourselves because we are intrinsically nature. And many of the behaviors that we have formed, you know, I guess in my opinion, in this modern age, is really much based on, you know, a lot of imbalances that have occurred between us and our relationship with ourselves and with Mother Earth. I want to also say Nyawe for the opportunity to speak. You know, there aren't very many avenues where the truth is actually able to be communicated to the general public about the situation of Six Nations. And I'd also like to acknowledge the Coast Salish people and thank them for allowing me to be here and to be able to speak and giving me that opportunity to express, you know, like my situation from my home territory, because like many people who are now living in this territory, I'm a visitor. I'm a guest. My ancestors are not from these lands. My bones and my blood do not run through the veins of the earth in this territory. And so therefore, you know, I honor and feel privileged that, you know, I have this opportunity. So, you know, to contextualize Indigenous struggle, and specifically the struggle that us as Haudenosaunee people have had in Six Nations, you know, a lot of it has been centered around governance, Indigenous self-governance, and sovereignty. And, you know, we have to understand, because, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, and there's this tendency to separate governance from nature, from the earth. And the way that our system traditionally was formulated was based on natural law. Our constitution, because we have an old constitution that goes far back before European contact, our constitution was based on natural law. It's called the Great Law of Peace, the Gayanlgoa. And this Great Law of Peace gave power and voice to every member of every clan and every nation. It didn't matter whether you were 2 years old or 79. You had a voice that was just as important as the next person in that community. There was no hierarchy. There was no one person who spoke for all. In fact, our Ruyane, which is our chiefs, when they chose to take on that title of chief, when they were like the way that Ruyane are granted title is that they are honorable men who are chosen. Well, traditionally, they were honorable men who were chosen by the clan to represent the voice of the people. And when that man took those horns upon his head, he lost his voice forever as a man, as an individual. No longer in his lifetime would he ever have a voice as an individual because he now carried the weight of his entire clan. Every man, woman, child, and not just the ones who are living now, but the coming faces, the generations ahead. The philosophies and the basis for our political system was not about us here today or us like living this life. It was about those coming generations. That there was no thought, no action made outside of that basic philosophy of life. Life continues. Regardless of whether you know, biologically gave birth or fathered a child, you still saw that the next coming generations were the reason why you lived your life and you lived it well. And so, you know, we've gone through a major transformation in this last year and a half. I've seen my people come from a very downtrodden place where we have almost completely lost our languages. We have almost completely lost our connection to this governance. And you saw this, and we saw this reawakening in my community that rejected the band council system, which is a Canadian-imposed, paternalistic, racist piece of legislation that still exists today and oppresses us right up to this point. And and this policy does not make us equals in this country. It makes us little brother, the one who can't look after themselves, the ones that the Canadian government, you know, has the obligation of looking after and making dependent. Well, in this last year, I think that there was a lot of people who began to wake up and realize there is something outside of that, and that that land, and we're talking about Southern Ontario, one of the most industrialized regions in Canada, you know, the lands that we are protecting, by no means are they as beautiful as out here in BC anymore. Our Grand River, the Grand River, which is the base of the treated lands that we are defending, our Grand River looks like chocolate milk. We get smog. We live in a natural wooded area, you know, very, very rural bush area, and yet we still get smog from Toronto and from Hamilton. Our animals are becoming mutated. We can't hunt. We can't fish. We don't have those opportunities anymore. But yet, we still defend that land because there is still a possibility to somehow, you know, amongst all this mess, and, you know, and I really appreciate having these, you know, these discussions and having this ability to really find, you know, solutions, because the land is not dead. She's sick, and she's our mother. You know, and these are sentiments that you hear, you know, many, many, many times from many people. But when our people reclaimed those development sites, you know, these suburban development sites, it was never about money. It was never even about ownership. It was about that inherent need to defend something that is so sacred to you. And in all honesty, most of us don't even know why. We didn't have the opportunity to be raised in, you know, a society that gave value to these ideas. In fact, any values we had, any way of speaking about the land, any way of thinking about the land, or in integrating the land into our lifestyles and our society and our government, have been taken away, disempowered. So, when we took those steps to reclaim that land last year, where many people sacrificed a lot, and what they sacrificed wasn't necessarily anything that is tangible, but rather it is more of this identity, this smoke and mirrors that keeps us oppressed, this idea that we are Indians, we're not Ongwehome, that status card with a registry number on it is what defines us, not what is in our heart or in our clan. And basically, when we went in there, many of us gave up many of the freedoms in this society, almost an illusionary society, to be able to stand up for what is actually you. And this has never been about exclusion. That's the other point I want to make, was a lot of people think, well, you're being separatist, or you're dividing, or you what do you want to do, kick everybody off this land and take it over, or you want us to pay you money? Well, it's never been about that. It's about having an equal place in this society, an equal place in this world. And the fact of the matter is the law of the land is the law of the land. And these lands were never surrendered. These lands, the law of the land is our law, our great law, which it's a very sort of little known fact to many that our great law of peace influenced much of the ideals in politics that we have today. Of course, it was taken completely away from the core of its being, which was natural law, having an innate connection and a continuous gratitude towards the giving of life. Rather, the mere structures were taken and used to form the American Constitution and modern ideas of democracy. In fact, there's theorists who have claimed that Marx was first influenced by the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And the original League of Nations, which existed before the United Nations, was based, when they researched a form of governance that could be inclusive to all nations, of all people, of all races, and of all lands of the entire earth, the only governance that has ever existed in history that could be applied to all people around the world was the Great Law of Peace. Because this Great Law of Peace was never about consolidating all people into one entity. It was about acknowledging the diversity within communities, within nations, and giving people a voice and working together in harmony, utilizing patience, utilizing discussion, utilizing thought. And this was a system that was matriarchal, and not in the sense that women were better than men or above men, but rather it was acknowledged that women are of the earth. Women give life. And so therefore, their bodies, there is not much separation between a woman's body and the land. The land gives life, the woman nurtures and gives life as well. She is mother, and so is the earth. And so when they were given this role of title holders, and these are English words, sometimes I feel very limited by English because it can't even begin to describe the sanctity behind these roles. She had that responsibility of taking care of that land, because that land was living and breathing, and her children and her children's children and all the children of that clan depended on that earth. There was no such thing as take, take, take. When the first settlers came to this land, I was talking about this a few days ago with my partner about how when they came here, what did they see? They saw this lush, fertile land with unendless resources. But guess why it was like that? Because our relationship with the land was so integrated that we did not just take, we gave back. And of course, there was abundance, huge abundance, because that was our responsibility to the land. Our responsibility to the land was to help it grow, help it survive, help it thrive. There were species of plants that would have gone extinct without the stewardship of indigenous peoples. And so I guess just to sum it all up, I also kind of wanted to take the opportunity to speak about sort of the current issue that has happened in my territory just within this last week, incident where a developer had gotten, quote-unquote, attacked by Native protesters. Now, again, this is another illusion that the media likes to put a spin on, because the truth is, before this man was hit in the head, he was beating up a 14-year-old Native boy with a bat. That's the truth. and his older brother, who is 18, found these five grown men beating up a 14-year-old boy, holding him up against the wall with a steel bar in his neck. What were they supposed to do? I've lived by the philosophy that I'd rather die standing than live on my knees. And unfortunately, the violence happens not because we bring that, but rather because it's brought to us. And we can't lay down and die. And what would you do if you saw your child, your little brother, your daughter, your sister, whatever, being brutalized? You would try to defend them and save them. And it's really unfortunate that it got to the point that it did. But this is how far this gap has been created. And I don't think anybody wants to see this violence continue. So, you know, nyawe for listening to what I've had to say. And thank you.
That was a report from Canadian Indigenous activist Lindsay Bomberry, a member of the Six Nations tribe in Ontario, Canada. Lindsay was in British Columbia when a developer was beaten by First Nations youth, or so the police say, protesting development of their land. Now we have her side of the story, not found in white-dominated media. This recording was made possible by Seven Oaks Online, the magazine of politics, culture, and resistance. Find them at sevenoaksmag.com.
The homeland of the Six Nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy has been divided by the U.S.-Canadian border, and their lands expropriated by both nations in violation of treaties dating back to the 18th century. Longtime listeners of the show will have heard the series on the land rights claims of the Onondaga against the state of New York. They, like the Six Nations in Canada, are seeking to reclaim, protect, and restore the health of their ancestral homelands. In this case, a large piece of land that now includes the cities of Syracuse and Binghamton and stretches from the Canadian border to Pennsylvania. Last week, the Onondaga and their non-Indian supporters filled a federal courtroom in Albany to hear their nation's lawyers make the case. Lawyers for the state of New York and the Onondaga Nation argued for about an hour whether the case should be dismissed without trial. The Onondaga Nation suit was filed in 2005 and asked the court to declare that New York violated federal and state laws when it acquired a 10 to 40 mile wide swath of land that stretches from Pennsylvania to Canada. The suit also asked the court to declare that the Onondagas still hold title to that land. Lawyers for the state of New York argue that the nation waited too long to file the case. However, the lawyer for the Onondaga Nation responded that they had been barred from state and federal courts for 185 years. According to the Post Standard, District Judge Kahn gave no indication of how long he will take to rule on the state's motion. In a similar claim filed by the Oneida Nation of New York, Kahn took 6 weeks to rule, deciding that the Oneidas had no possessory rights to 250,000 acres in Madison and Oneida counties, but said they might be entitled to profits the state made when it resold the land. The sad reality is that the Haudenosaunee, whether in the U.S. or Canada, are outnumbered by settler societies that do not honor their treaties, while in the Andean nations, the indigenous people are in the majority and are organizing to use their might to attain their rights.